There's a question period. You don't have to stay for the question period. Although most of you are so hemmed in that there's no point trying to escape. But there's a question period. And yes. Yes. I am. The Illuminati. They asked about the Illuminati, which is the name given to a group of very, very powerful people, right, who are getting together and who are making decisions about what will happen to the world. I mean, there have been various manifestations of the Illuminati, you know, over time. You know, after World War II, there was a Trilateral Commission in which, after World War II, the United States and countries in Western Europe and Japan and some important people, government people, corporation people, some important journalists, you know, powerful people got together in the Trilateral Commission. And they said, now let's look at the world and where it is now. They did this after the Vietnam War. And they said, what do we do now? And where do we go? And what is our strategy? And so on. And so there's, as you say, the Illuminati. Who, you know, you're referring to a specific book?
Several books.
The number of books written. And all I can say is, I don't have inside information about these people, but and I don't even believe it. You know, I don't believe it's necessary for like a finite group of people to get together in a room and to plan all the terrible things that go on in the world, because these terrible things are driven by what they call market forces. It's the wonderful thing about the so-called free market that all you have to do is have a system in which profit drives policy. And if money, profit, drives policy, then there will be a natural selection of events which will move everything towards disaster, you see, really. And so, but from time to time, yes, important people do get together and they talk with one another and they try to figure out, you know, what to do and how to deal with threats. You know, I don't doubt that after Seattle, you know, there were conferences that took place. And you would think, well, what? They don't have to do this, do they? They're so powerful, and we're so, you know, small. But the fact is that powerful people worry. They worry that small movements will become big movements. I mean, that's why the FBI did all... That's why the FBI did ridiculous things going after people who had very little power, because they are paranoid, you know. Although, actually, it's not paranoia. I take that back. They are realistic. They know that small movements become big movements. They know that one person on a picket line could become 10 and 100 and 1,000 and a huge... They know that, you know. So, but I figure we can't... You know, concentrate on what they're doing and thinking. We know what, you know, what they're up to, and our job is to work for the things we believe in, food, not bombs, and women's rights, and racial equality, and the rights of gays and lesbians, and of disabled people and of children, and to work on all of these things and cause them more worry. Not spend our time penetrating, their inner circles, but creating our own enormous circles, which will then finally make their inner circle impotent.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What type of organizing or social change work gives you the most hope these days?
What kind of organizing gives me the most hope these days? Well, I think it's the kind of organizing that unites various groups around what I think may be the central issue for this next period in American history. There's a kind of organizing that took place in Seattle, in Washington, and in Prague, and which is international in scope, and which is based on an alliance among many, many different groups who have different agendas, whether it's feminism or environmentalism or, decent wage for low-paid people, health and care, and so on. What unites all of these people is the fact that none of these things are obtainable, none of the things that people need are obtainable unless we have a massive change in the way the resources of the society are distributed, and the economic system, and so any kind of organizing that is aimed at that very fundamental thing, that kind of radical thing, redistribution of wealth, tearing away more and more at the system that is based on corporate profit, and trying to build a society more and more based on human need. That kind of multi-group and international organizing, it seems to me, is the most important. Yes.
Right now, I'm studying at college to become a history teacher, and I was wondering, as a teacher, if you have any advice for someone who's going to be dealing with the institutional structure.
Advice for somebody who's going to be a history teacher?
Yes.
Advice. Advice for somebody who's going to be a history teacher. Find friends. Find allies. Because you're going into a snake pit. If you go into an institution, you're going to a university, you go into the academic world, or you go into a school system, you're going to face bureaucrats, and you're going to face narrow-minded department heads and colleagues who look askance at anybody who moves outside the parameters of the textbook, you see. You're going to face all of that. So you're going to be a minority, and so you're going to have to fight, and you shouldn't have to fight alone. That's why I say look for friends. And the friends you'll find among maybe a few colleagues, but the greatest friends you'll find is among students. And the student-faculty alliances are very, very important. And there have been times when faculty have run into great, great difficulty with administrations which decided those faculty should be gotten rid of. And when students organized, they were able to keep the faculty and the institution. So, yeah. And I guess the other thing is teach the way you want to. Don't be intimidated into teaching what they want you to teach. It's very easy to be intimidated, very easy to be a history teacher who goes to radical rallies and this and that, but who in the classroom follows, the curriculum you're given and the textbooks that you're given. You don't have to burn the textbooks that you're given, but you can supplement them with good stuff, you see. And, it's a kind of, when you're a teacher in the system, you play a kind of guerrilla warfare with the system. And the reward is the reactions of your students. and you're feeling better about yourself than if you just follow the rules. Yes. About the situation in Colombia.
When I read about it in the paper, they justify spending $1.3 billion on the drug war to fight terrorists and Marxist rebels. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about what is really underlying.
Well, you probably know the answer to that, right? Oh. Of course you do. Oh. I've said don't follow instructions and, you know, be independent and do what you want. But when somebody says, get to the microphone, you know, I quail. No. This woman has asked about the situation in Colombia. You know, the $1.456 billion the United States is giving to Colombia, mostly in military aid, presumably to fight the drug war, but indeed basically to keep the present government of Colombia in power and to fight the guerrilla movement in Colombia, which is based on the poverty of the Colombian people. So I know you know, you know, very often when people ask you questions like that, it's because they know the answers, but, right? What's that? What is
why
the real reason?
Why we feel the need to fight a war there?
The real reason why the United States is doing what it's doing?
Yeah.
Well, I think basically the same reason why the United States has intervened again and again in other countries and given military aid to other countries. It's to prevent, we don't want another Castro in Colombia. We don't want another Sandinista government in Colombia. We don't want a revolutionary movement to succeed in Colombia, which might not become a satellite of the United States. We want to maintain American influence in Colombia, and we will support whatever regime, however repressive that regime is, and this Colombian government has been repressive, we will support any kind of repressive regime and keep it in power. Because then it will play ball with American corporations and with the American political leadership. I think that's the reason. Yes. Excuse me?
As the number one world power.
Yes. United States, yeah.
Doing good, I mean, that's how the mainstream media is portraying us as these peacekeepers.
Oh.
What is your take on that?
The question is there a positive role that the United States could play in this conflict in the Middle East? Are the media portraying the United States as the peacekeepers and right, we're the, you know, we will mediate and so on and so forth? Well, it's sort of, for the United States to mediate a conflict between the Israeli government and the Palestinians is a very odd kind of situation. I mean, we've been brought into it because we're so powerful and because we insist on being the mediator. But, of course, the United States has been allied to Israel. It hasn't been allied to the Palestinian movement. It's been allied to Israel and has been giving Israel huge amounts of military and economic aid over the years. And so to expect the United States to mediate in this successfully in this situation doesn't really make any sense. And in fact, it hasn't worked. Whatever the United States comes up with will be suspect in the Palestinian world. And the most constructive thing that the United States can do is to make to decide something that's very hard for the Israeli government to decide, because the Israeli government is beset by the extremists in Israel, you see. But the United States, not beset by those extremists, having, sure, there's a pro-Israeli lobby in the United States and so on, but it's not as serious. It can be dealt with. What the United States should be doing is taking a hard look at the situation. Now I'm talking about something utopian, because the United States is not going to do this. But you ask, what could the United States? The United States should, as I say, could say what the Israeli government cannot say. The Israelis have been occupying Palestinian territory. At the end of World War II, they took what was 100% Palestinian land, and they, they insist on taking the 20% that they won by military victory in 1967 and occupying it, or finally, after an intifada and after all so much resistance, the United States is willing to say, and Israeli willing to say, and the United States willing to go along, we'll withdraw from part of, or even most of, the occupied territories, we are not going to say that this territory belongs to the Palestinians because it's Palestinian territory. It's as if after the American Revolution, the British said, we'll get out of 11 of the colonies, but not out of 11 of the states, but we insist on maintaining troops in 2 of the 13 states. And it's a very simple matter. Very simple matter of justice that the Palestinians, having been driven out of the rest of Israel after 1948, deserve to have that territory, that 20% that was taken by force in the 1967 war, and where the vast majority of the people living there are Palestinians. They deserve to have Israel military force out of there. And that's, so the United States should be saying that and saying to Israel, if you don't do that, you're not going to get our military aid anymore. Now, Israel, that's talking very tough to Israel.